Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem bristles at some of the reporting on her and her response to coronavirus in South Dakota. And how does the state deal with an expected budget shortfall? The Dakota political junkies have their work cut out for them today. We're joined by Michael Card, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. Professor Card, welcome back.
Thank you, Lori. It's wonderful to be here.
We also have with us Jonathan Ellis with the Argus Leader. Jonathan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
All right.
Or good afternoon.
Right. Here we are. Everybody's healthy. Everybody's here. Let's start with some of the natural, I guess, maybe that's editorialized to say this is natural, but it seems like once a governor is in the national spotlight, like Governor Noem has, like Governor Chris Cuomo of, or Governor Cuomo, now I'm getting the brothers confused. Oh boy, rough beginning here. But the governors are really in the news a lot, and that means there's going to be some national attention and some national criticism, some local criticism of that, and Governor Kristi Noem is feeling the sting of that a little bit. And is lashing out and saying some of this coverage is not fair. She has taken particular umbrage with a report from the Associated Press and has pointed journalists to another piece that she thinks is more more accurate depiction of the facts. So we're going to talk about this a little bit. Jonathan, let's start with you. Pretty common for a political leader to lash out at the press, or is this a new playbook that we're looking at here?
You know, I would say that it's maybe newer in South Dakota politics, but I think that certainly with the current president, the press has been very antagonistic to him, and sometimes deservedly so, probably, and sometimes maybe not. But I think we've reached a new level, and certainly in South Dakota, I think what we're seeing now with the pushback from Noem's new team, they're a little more aggressive at combating what they think is unfair press coverage. And I've certainly tangled with them recently, and I expect we'll probably tangle again. You know, I will say, though, that, you know, there have always been times where there's friction between the press and the governor's office, certainly with Bill Janklow. You know, during the Mike Rounds era, you know, we had sued my newspaper, had sued the Rounds administration to get various records. And there was a time when Rounds, because of that lawsuit, used that as an excuse to say, nobody in state government can talk with the Argus Leader. I think under Dennis Dugard, that was the relationships between that governor's office and press was much better than it had been, certainly in the Rounds and Janklow days. And I think maybe we kind of returned a little bit to a little more of an antagonistic, time when there's a lot going on. And so obviously there are going to be some hard feelings at times.
Right. Mike Carr, do you want to weigh in on just that in general, right before we get to some specific questions about some of the coverage that she appreciates and some of the coverage that she doesn't like?
Well, let's move on to that.
All right, because I want to talk about specifically, she's upset with this AP story, and it is written by Thomas Beaumont and Stephen Groves. And the headline is A Resume for Future Office, Virus Tests a GOP Governor. And it's a look at how she's dealt with the pandemic, but also how she's dealt with having a TV studio in the state capitol and the number of times she's appeared on Fox News and on national podcasts, her seeking advice from Trump's former advisor, Corey Lewandowski. There are two named sources in the article. When you kind of scroll down a little bit, people who are not authorized to talk, who are talking about her potential aspirations. And the governor's office says, not so fast. She doesn't have those. She doesn't have those aspirations. That's not fair. It's not well sourced. Jonathan, tell us a little bit before we talk about that, about this new team that you're talking about and how you've tangled with them before, because that's been I'm not asking you to share any secrets, because that played out on Twitter.
Yeah, Maggie Seidel comes from Washington, D.C. I don't think she had any ties to South Dakota when she came. She's a Washington. She comes from Washington. So they play kind of by a different set of rules, I think, than certainly you know, we're used to people who are from South Dakota. So it's a little more hardball with them, and that's fine. That's just the nature of the relationship. It's, at the end of the day, it's really nothing personal. We're all trying to do our jobs here. But so that's, you know, it's a new element that we have never seen, at least since I've been here, of bringing in people from that world into this world.
Yeah. Mike, the criticism that speculation about her political future is unfair and not a good thing at the time. She doesn't want that in the press. Do you think that's a fair call from the governor to say, don't write about that?
Well, she's got an agenda that she's trying to push, and that is of managing the state's response to COVID-19. On the other hand, I think she's got dual roles to play there, one of which is, it's been very clear to me, I don't know, you know, if we cite John Miller, I don't know that I have the facts to back it up, but it appears from the news reporting that in order to get the president's favor, you have to appear on Fox News. And if you appear on Fox News, then you're likely to get resources for the state. So I could easily understand if part of the reaction especially with the TV studio is, well, you have to appear. We can't afford to be gone. So a TV studio is the way to go. I think a second part is we've really come into, with social media, a never-ending reelection campaign. And I think that's part of, you know, I'll put words in Jonathan's mouth and let him refute those. The rationale for bringing in Washington outsiders is we see a never-ending campaign of managing our appearance. And for most of us, we make lots of mistakes. But if you're a political figure in this world today, you can't afford to be labeled with making a mistake, whatever that is.
Hmm. And sometimes you can't afford
retorts.
Jonathan, did you want to retort? I have no retort.
Well, I mean, I do like the point about social media. You know, I mean, that's right. Yeah. We're on, and obviously the president is on social media, and so that's, yeah. And Michael makes a great, big point. I mean, it's kind of a perpetual deal now. You're always at it. You're always working on, you know, responses to, you know, news articles, or you're always working on, you know, you're grooming your image. It's perpetual. Michael's definitely right about that.
Yeah, and he brings up a point too about what the president is watching. And Maggie Seidel, in her email to reporters, said, "Take a look at this coverage in the Federalist, which was written by a national reporter named Molly Hemingway, with connections to Fox News and Hillsdale College." Who basically has a different story about how things have unfolded and what people should be focusing on. And the question I'm wondering here, Mike, is this notion of who's the audience here? If the president, you know, Maggie's kind of pointing out that you don't get resources for South Dakota unless you have a relationship with the White House. She has a relationship with Mike Pence. She has a relationship with the president. Maggie didn't say this, but we're kind of putting pieces together saying you go on Fox News because that's where he's tuning in and that's where he's going to see you. And you say these things and then you get things like, you know, the relief that you're asking for, the testing supplies that you're asking for. Is that kind of this narrative that's playing out is not just of how I want to be perceived, but there's two different places. There's multiple places to get your news sources and therefore different narratives. And the president believes one set of them.
I guess that's where I've been coming from, is at least part of me gives her a little bit of slack to say she's actually doing the right thing. And while I might have a hard time doing that, she's reconciled that this is the way to get resources for the state. I think there is a series of other issues to claim that she doesn't have any aspirations. Well, we'll find out. I mean, that's an empirical question. She will either show those aspirations or she won't.
Jonathan, thoughts on that? When do we start seeing whether these are aspirations to just help the people of South Dakota in the way that she as governor sees fit? And when do we see that really this is part of an overall strategy to somehow be in national politics in the future?
Well, let's just say this. One thing can be two things, right? I mean, that's just simple. So that could be both things here. To go back to the Molly Hemingway article that they are promoting as a as good journalism. And just so full disclosure, I went to Hillsdale, and my wife's a Hillsdale graduate. So in Molly Hemingway is fairly prominent in conservative politics. And I think at the base of what their complaint is that, what's in the press, you hear a lot of, people need to lock, the governors need to lock down their states. And so I think a lot of the pushback that they're trying to, that they're saying, like, look, the governor in South Dakota is able to actually manage this. And so it's this narrative that's taken place among a lot, mostly Democratic governors against, a handful of Republican governors. And I think that was sort of the basis, that's where the fault line is right now between, I think, liberals and conservatives, is this whole notion of were the lockdowns necessary, for the future. And so I think that's where we'll see a lot of this pushback now with regard to how the Governor Noem has handled this.
Right. And Molly mentions in her piece, she's citing the AP piece, about Mayor Paul Tenhaken. And I thought that was also interesting because he did come out critical and asking for more help from the governor, was very vocal about that. But then he went on CNN and I heard them ask about his governor, and he just said nothing but, praise for her on a national spotlight. So the message that you hear is not always the same depending on what platform that you're on and what audience you're speaking to, which is interesting
that
and
is
frustrating
correct.
At
yeah.
the same time. Yeah. Tell us about Hillsdale.
Oh, let's do that over beers.
Okay. I have questions. I have questions about,
Sure.
We'll do that over beers. Let's talk a little bit about the state budget, because as we look at the response for the governor, clearly there are a lot of different ways to evaluate that response, and one is from a public health standpoint and one is from an economic standpoint. We're seeing some of those early numbers come in, and Mike Card, you've had a chance to look at them probably more carefully than I have, and I'm wondering what are some of the things that we're seeing, because it's not a complete picture yet. It's an early picture, but it's an interesting one for sure.
It is. South Dakota has a budget of over $5 billion. 1.7 of that is what we call a general fund that is sort of like our main family checking account, if you will. There's some danger in making that analogy, but I think that's one that makes sense to most of us, is it's the one that we pay the day-to-day operations out of. We pay our mortgage bills, we buy our groceries, and things of that nature. And what we're seeing from the March figures, March to March 2019 to 2020, there really wasn't much of a change. What we are seeing from April of 2019 to 2020, and even in terms of the legislature and the governor's office's Bureau of Finance and Management, is we're down about $18 million from that. So we're expecting a decline in the general fund of 20% to 30%, at least that's what the experts are saying. So what that means for South Dakota is if 50% of our dollars go to fund education and to fund people who can't take care of themselves and to incarcerate people to protect them from themselves and us from them, that's really where we're seeing this decline of in the neighborhood of $500 million if the 30% decline holds forward.
Jonathan, as you look at these numbers, and Governor Noem's, pointed out in her last press briefing or a couple days ago, I'm kind of lost track of time, but the timing of this is interesting. We haven't seen the full impact of these because some of the sales tax receipts are up in certain areas, food stores, for example, and building materials and hardware stores. People are doing home improvements and things like that, even though they're staying home. Hotels, clothing, restaurants, terrible numbers there for that. What are you seeing when you look at the numbers, and what do you sort of expect the story in the days ahead to be?
Well, I mean, some of it's not a surprise, obviously, in the sectors that you mentioned. I mean, restaurants are basically shut down. I'm hopeful that we can kind of maybe turn a corner here at some point. There's no doubt that this is going to have an effect on revenues, both state and local governments here, for sure. And but, you know, anecdotally, I do see just a lot of economic activity still out there. I mean, it's not like everything is, you know, it's a ghost town out there. I go out and do some reporting, and there are a lot of people out and about doing stuff. So yeah. I think it could have been a lot worse, and it could be a lot worse. So I think as this plays out, I mean, this is a snapshot in time, and we're going to have to see as everything evolves in this whole thing, how that plays out.
And so much of this, Jonathan, can't be controlled in the sense that, you know, there has been much focus about what the governor or the mayor or the president has mandated. But truthfully, if you're at a smaller town in South Dakota, for example, and you really haven't had community spread yet, you've had a couple cases, and all of a sudden you do, that's going to change how people feel about going out and about, and people are going to start making some of those decisions that can be catastrophic to public health or great public health decisions or catastrophic to the economy. It's not all about the mandate and the policy, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think that, a coworker I was talking to today was saying he was out in the country at the gas station getting coffee, and a bunch of farmers were sitting around, and I think there was about a dozen of them, he said, and they were definitely not social distancing. And so as you know, at some point when you get out into those communities that haven't seen this and it starts to, you get one or two people who get it, I think then it has a bigger consequence. So again, I mean, a lot of this making conclusions about, you know, the disease itself, the virus itself, how we're responding to it, the economics of it. I mean, all of this is just, everything is so fluid right now that we're making a lot of interesting conclusions on something that is, you know, in 2 months might be totally different. So yeah, it's snapshots in time, you know.
Right. But Dr. Card, education, it seems not a stretch to say that the education budget in a state where that has been such a challenge in the past, and teachers' pay has been such a challenge, university services, it's, you know, incredibly hard on colleges, just deciding whether to send students home or not, to send refunds or not. Colleges are spending more money on online platforms and are losing money. There's tough days ahead, aren't there?
Well, I think there are tough days ahead, but in South Dakota, we're kind of used to that. We have a belief that we should have the lowest level of government possible. And I think Governor Noem captures the political culture appropriately in terms of individual responsibility. And in some senses, that's a wonderful thing. And in some senses, that can be a terrible thing if we overwhelm our resources. In South Dakota, we really have three worlds. We have a Sioux Falls, Rapid City, metropolitan world. We have a small town world, and we have an extremely rural world. And we haven't had that real Rock Hudson moment yet. That is, referring back to the AIDS crisis, when we recognized if Rock Hudson can get AIDS, then maybe I can too. Now, there's lots of dissimilarities between acquired immune deficiency syndrome or AIDS and the coronavirus or COVID-19. But I think to some extent, people change their behavior when they learn of people who do get COVID-19, and especially when someone they know has to be hospitalized or someone passes away. It's a real challenge that we have in this state because these are such different worlds and we only live in one generally.
Yeah, I think that's so smart. And I realize that because of what I do here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. But sometimes even I get caught up in that. And it was not, I suppose, last summer, last fall, where I went somewhere and literally everyone who heard I was from Sioux Falls asked me about the crime rate and asked me if I was scared to live in Sioux Falls. And Jonathan, I had to come back home and search the Argus Leader. I'm like, do we have a crime rate problem that I'm not aware of? Because that was not my perception of living in Sioux Falls at all. And I think I got asked like 11 times, anybody who said, where do you live? And I said, I live in Sioux Falls. Stabbings and murders, and they had a real impression that was drastically different from my impression from just going to work and living my life every day. So Mike's right. The idea of this being a Sioux Falls story right now, or a Minnehaha County story, can make a difference in the days ahead with how people behave and how that changes if there are different hotspots or clusters throughout the state.
Oh, definitely. And I think that that observation that Mike made, that's why you pay him the big bucks, because that was a, right? That was a good observation.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I
well
say,
said.
I will say, you know, that in Huron, which was sort of the ground zero when this all started, you know, Mike's right on. I mean, a couple people got it, and there were a couple fatalities there, unfortunately. And but I think that changed the behavior in that in Huron changed very quickly. And they have not had I have not had a new case now here, or Beetle County has not had a new case. And I should make sure I look at today's data, but I don't think they've had a case in probably about a month. I mean, so the behavior changed quickly there.
Right. I want to close and make sure we talk about this South Dakota Supreme Court ruling that has to do with forced catheterization. Oh, thanks, Jonathan. Say it for me, because my brain is tired today, apparently.
You're doing it just fine.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Tell us what's changed in that story, because this is an ongoing saga.
Yeah, this is it was actually a federal court ruling by Roberto Lang, who the chief judge right now in the federal district court system, who for trivia purposes is the son of longtime state lawmaker Gerald Lang from Lake County, Madison. So just a little trivia there. But anyway, it was a ruling that the forced catheterization practice that law enforcement uses to extract urine involuntarily for people who run afoul of the law for some reason was unconstitutional, and it was really I call it the opinion was really kind of a Christmas tree of quotes. Very clearly Lang did not like this practice, and that was there were many quotes to choose pull from it. It'll be interesting to see. I didn't get a response if anybody plans to appeal this to the Eighth Circuit, or there will be a trial. This is something that will probably be appealed. And in Lang's ruling, he noted that there were two cases where people weren't even necessarily confronted by law enforcement because of something because of they were suspected of drug use or anything. In two cases of the six he heard. One of them was just on a bench warrant. They decided to catheterize this guy to see if they could get him for having drugs, because, again, South Dakota is one of the few places, one of the only states, if not the only state, in which you can get a drug charge if they detect it in your urine. So it's a practice that has been highly controversial. My former colleague, who's now at the New York Times, Mark Walker, did a great investigative series on that a few years ago.
Mike Cards. The story in the Argus Leader at argusleader.com that Jonathan Ellison wrote about this, and then there's a link to the Mark Walker piece with the details of this. It does seem pretty gratuitous, but I guess that's an opinion as well. Help me out as we close our segment.
Judge Lang laid out in 106 pages recounting the particulars of each particular catheterization, and included videos taken by law enforcement that showed three of the plaintiffs screaming in agony. I think this violates what most of us would consider to be appropriate behavior by law enforcement. And having witnesses watch this as medical personnel were directed to catheterize people. And, you know, our U.S. Constitution is basically set up around freedom from government, especially with the Bill of Rights, the first 10 Amendment, of which this is the 8th Amendment, prohibiting it's always good to lose your train of thought right in the middle on the radio. 4th Amendment.
This is the third time this happened to me in this one segment, Mike.
That's incredible.
Right. I think that we'll leave it there. And this has been a great conversation, and you get to see how every once in a while my mind just sort of melts down as we go through all these stuff. I think it was the numbers that did it, Mike, all those numbers. And but thank you so much, Jonathan Ellis. We appreciate your time. You can find Jonathan's work at argusleader.com. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks. We'll have those socially distanced beers.
Right. Mike Carr, thank you as well. I appreciate it so much.
Well, a wonderful day to you, Laurie, and to you as well, John.